Welcome to a podcast of The Mike Novak Show. You can listen to Mike live Sunday mornings from 9 to 11 Central on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go,
make it so.
Make it so. Make it so. Ma'am,
it doesn't show signs of stopping.
And I brought me some tea, Earl Grey, hot. The
lights
are
turned
way down low.
Make it so.
Make it so. Make it so. When we finally kiss.
Good night.
How I hate going out in
the storm. But if you...
Really?
Shut up, Wesley!
All the way home, I'll be
warm. Oh, the fire is slowly dying. And my dear...
We're still goodbye, then.
But as long as you love me,
so...
Make it so.
Make it so.
Make it so.
Live from the beautiful Showcase Studios on North Milwaukee Avenue in Chicago, in between Andy's Deli and Lido Banquets, and just a punch key's throw away from the Polish capital of the Western Hemisphere. It's The Mike Novak Show, Chicago's only locally broadcast deep green gardening and environment program, heard every Sunday right here on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. True currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in demand.
This hour of The Mike Novak Show is brought to you by Recycled Granite, featuring eco-friendly split stone veneers and handmade products by individuals with disabilities. Go to recycledgranite.com. To Mike, it's not just another banana peel, it's future dirt. Here he is, Mike Novak.
Well, here we are in the countdown to the last days of the Kickstarter campaign. And as you find out next week, the last days possibly to something else. I'm going to get to that in a second. But first of all, my thanks to all the folks who have been contributing to my Kickstarter campaign for my very first book, Attack of the Killer Asparagus. And by the way, Carrie Morris is
good
here.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. Carrie had filled in for us several weeks ago. I forget what show that was. Was that... which is when I was in New York.
New York.
Okay,
yes.
When I was in New York. And I appreciate that, and I appreciate you being here today.
Oh, thank you. I love being here.
We're a little shorthanded. And Carrie does a lot of different things around the station, including phones and some voice stuff. And you work with Out Chicago, which is on right after us.
I do.
And other programs as well.
So, Hail on Saturday, sometimes Hail Sparks on Saturday.
There you go. A little bit of everything. So thank you for being here. I got this thing in the mail today. And by the way, in terms of the Kickstarter campaign, the number of days I'm clicking on right now, and we'll see when the computer, I think we're at eight, if I'm not mistaken. I think, we should be there because it launched. Okay, here it is. Survey says, how many? It's not telling me how many days. Huh. Well, by Tuesday, April 1st at 8:41 a.m. Yeah, there it is. Now, it popped up late. It's eight. We're still at 8 days. We're at 8 days right now.
How much money have you raised?
We have raised over $4,000.
Wow, in only 8 days?
No. In 21 days.
Oh, well, that's still really good.
Or 22 days. However, you get like a month to do this. Okay. But we're on our way to our goal of 5,000. And I come in today, and there's this letter. Mike, I'm a faithful listener on the real wireless, parentheses, radio. Love it. Old school. I tried to donate to Kickstarter, but they sent me to the ultimate big box, Jeff Bezos' Amazon. I try to steer clear of involvement with the big boys, so I'm sending the money to you. I'd be devastated if your show went off the air. Well, it's connected to the Kickstarter. The Kickstarter technically is to get the book published. But if I have to reach into my pocket for $5,000, it doesn't help the show a whole lot. All right, here we go. Might I suggest you find a speaker who knows how to grow food from store-bought food, such as broccoli, potatoes, Brussels sprouts, and celery. I start them out well, but they quickly die. What am I doing wrong? Thanks for everything you do. And it, Alan signs this. I won't give you away, Alan. And I'm not going to tell you. He sends me a check. The check is right here in the mail, as they say, with a nice card that goes with it. And he says, P.S., naturally, you can put this money to good use with Kickstarter. And then on the back of the letter, it says, this is the best part. Alan, I love you. It says, sir, save or recycle the card just as we want to save the butterflies. And that is in reference to you, Doug Tarin, I guess. Because I mentioned last week that Doug would be on the show this morning, and we will be getting to Doug, who is the curator of biology and vice president of research and conservation for the Chicago Academy of Sciences and Peggy Notobart Nature Museum. And it's a pleasure to have you back on the show. We'll get to you in a second. So I wanted to thank Alan for that. So that contribution is added to the total. So we're in the neighborhood of $900 away. That's not that much. And I'm hoping that folks who are listening right this morning who have been thinking about it will realize that we're in the home stretch here. And people forget. Sometimes they mean to do things and they forget. And so they get around to it. What I've been told about Kickstarter is that there's a hockey curve, much like the hockey curve with the carbon in our atmosphere. So it goes whoop up like this at the end, and I'm kind of hoping that's the case so that we can make our goal. So we're right around $4,100 out of 5,000, and I hope folks will. And by the way, you're not just throwing money at me. We're giving you premiums. There will be autographed copies of the book, autographed by me, autographed by Allie Hunter, who is my illustrator and just a wonderful illustrator. Her drawings alone are worth the price of admission. And we also, if you go in big time, she will do a personal illustration for you. But you gotta, that's a $500 one, but she's really good. And she can do your favorite veggie or probably something else if you want.
That's a great incentive.
I think so. And we also have at the 250 level, it is some of the original art that she's done. And by the way, you know, Attack of the Killer Asparagus is based on my columns for Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. And she has already been illustrating that for a number of years. So some of those original illustrations will go out to people who make contributions, and I already have. So that's another incentive if you want to get involved. So the idea is, hey, you're not just throwing money at me. You're doing it and getting something in return. And that's sort of the premise of Kickstarter. Help me help you, I guess, because you need my book. Everybody needs I had somebody actually write that. The world needs Mike's book. I'm thinking, okay, sure.
Very loyal listeners.
I know I do.
That's good.
I do, indeed.
Your book's going to make it. You're going to get there.
Well, I hope so. And the other thing I want to say, and before we get to Doug, And the other people on the show today. And by the way, the second hour, we're going to have a talk that you've not heard on radio before, I think, at least not in detail. And that's about light pollution. And I didn't realize, I mean, I have always been disturbed by light pollution, and sometimes I feel like I'm just crying out in the wilderness because who cares? Well, people do care, including Audrey Fisher from the Chicago Astronomical Society and Mark Hammergren from the Adler Planetarium and Dr. David Blask from Tulane Medical Center, the University School of Medicine. So there are actually physical repercussions of having too much light in our society. We're going to talk about that in the second hour. I think it's going to be fascinating. And then finally, all right, I'm going to say this, and I actually mean this. You know me. I can wax hyperbolic, I guess. Hyperbole. I'm given to that occasionally. But next week, I think the second hour might be the most important hour of radio you will listen to in your lifetime. Okay, can I say that without?
Are you going to tell us why?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. It's a guy I heard last week for the first time. I caught him on Tom Hartman's show. And his he is a guy who's talking about, well, his name is Guy McPherson. And he's professor emeritus at the University of Arizona. He has his blog called Nature Bats Last, as in baseball. Nature Bats Last. And it's actually Guy McPherson, or McPherson, however you pronounce it, .com, and I will find out. McPherson. And it's his blog about climate change and what is likely to happen very, very, very soon, a lot sooner than we think, and why this is going to happen and what the consequences will be. As he writes on his column, American actress Lily Tomlin is credited with the expression, "No matter how cynical you become, it's never enough to keep up." With respect to climate science, my own efforts to stay abreast are blown away every week by new data, models, and assessments. It seems no matter how dire the situation becomes, it only gets worse when I check the latest reports. And then he goes on from there, and he goes on for pages. And I've read a lot of that, and it will blow you away. So he's going to be on the show at 10 o'clock next week, along with Carrie Leiterson, who's an environmental reporter in Illinois and has done some marvelous work. And the three of us actually are going to have at it. And this is in anticipation of Guy, who is going to be speaking at Paul Henry's Gallery in Hammond, Indiana, on April 1st at 7 p.m. And apparently, and I don't know if this has been confirmed, but he's also supposed to speak next Sunday at the Multiculti, which is 1000 North Milwaukee in Chicago, and just down Milwaukee here. That's supposed to be at 3 p.m. And so I managed to get a hold of him. Thank you to Thomas Frank for helping me with that. And lo and behold, he's going to be on this program next Sunday at 10 a.m. And like I said, maybe the most important hour of radio you ever listen to. And I don't take that lightly. And I don't mean it lightly. All right. The Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. Doug Tarin is coming up in a second. So hang on.
If you've ever filed a lawsuit, you know that it can be stressful, even traumatic. And if you've been exposed to asbestos, silica dust, or other lung toxins, you're going to need a law firm that can guide you through the legal maze efficiently and effectively. The attorneys of Penn Rakowski are exactly who you're looking for. They view each client and their needs as unique. They're focused on one thing and one thing only, lung disease. And they're based right here in Illinois and Wisconsin. The lawyers at Penn Rakowski have been representing individuals suffering from lung disease and their families for a combined 35 years. And because they're local, they can come to you. They've successfully represented asbestos workers, electricians, carpenters, machinists, and others throughout both states. Contact Penn Rakowski at dustlaw.com or call them toll-free at 888-LUNG-LAW. That's 888-LUNG-LAW. Penn Rakowski, local, committed, caring.
Trying to weather the housing market? Consider replacing your windows and siding. Remodeling Magazine says they're some of the nation's most popular projects today.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for all your remodeling and energy needs. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Do you love fresh vegetables? Do you have the time to grow them yourself? Sometimes the answer to the first question is yes, and the answer to the second is no. In that case, you should consider a CSA share from Purple Leaf Farms. CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture. Here's how it works. You pay up front to help get the farm get their crops in the ground and harvested. And when they're ready for harvest, guess who gets the first choice? Yes, you. If you sign on with Purple Leaf Farms, starting in late June or early July, you'll begin receiving weekly shipments of produce that are fresher than fresh. They employ organic methods, no synthetic chemicals, herbicides, pesticides, or synthetic fertilizers. You'll receive 6 types of vegetables, 2 types of herbs, and 1 large mixed flower bouquet every week for 15 weeks. Fresh flowers. Come on. You're not going to take advantage of that? Order a CSA from Purple Leaf Farms today. You will not be disappointed. For more information, go to purpleleaffarms.com or call 312-437-7542. 312-437-7542.
It's time to step in the green room.
Life's a garden, dig it. You make it work for you.
In the Green Room with Mike is brought to you by Christy Weber Farm and Garden at CWFNG.com. Let them inspire you to create your own oasis. And I'm happy to have them as a sponsor for this and welcome them back for a new season. And as I mentioned before, in the studio with me is Doug Tarin, who is the curator of biology and vice president of research and conservation, Chicago Academy of Sciences, and Peggy Notobart Nature Museum. I like to think of you as the butterfly guy, but there's probably a few other people who do as well, don't you think?
I have been called that before.
Have
yes.
you? Okay, so is it on your license plate? That's what I want to know.
It is not on my license plate, no.
Maybe it should be.
Perhaps.
Yeah. I can arrange it. Let's sit down. We'll figure this out. I mean, how many other people out there are going to call them? Of course, it's too many letters. You'd have to, you know, do one of those weird things where they contract the... I saw one of those the other day, and it took me 35, 40, 50 seconds to figure out what it meant. And my feeling is you contract the letters so much that you've got people just guessing at what it is you mean, then there's no point in it, right?
You've kind of blown it, yeah.
Doug, you and I haven't sat down on the radio for a long, long time. It was back when I was at Gargantua Radio down the dial that we last did this. So I'm glad to have you back, and I've been thinking about doing this for a long time because, as you know, anybody who's paying half attention knows, it's not just our butterflies, but our insects in general are kind of in trouble. We're not helping them a whole lot, are we?
There's been a lot of decline in a lot of species, and I of course pay most attention to the butterflies. In the last couple of years, in particular, have been kind of tough to see what's going on. Some of my favorite species have really crashed over the past few years.
All right, name a couple that that's happened to. And you don't even have to say monarch, okay? But we know that's at the top of the list for a lot of people.
Right. Well, the monarch, of course, is the one everybody is familiar with. But things like Baltimore checker spots and eyed browns, which are two lovely wetland butterflies on a number of sites, particularly last year, somewhat the year before, they have simultaneously shown some unprecedented declines on multiple places around the Chicago area, and we're not really quite sure exactly what's going on there.
Well, that's interesting, and I should point out that that's your area of study. Your primary area of study is wetland butterflies, right?
Well, I've been a steward on a wetland since the early 1980s, and so I pay particular attention to wetland butterflies. But I also do a fair bit of work with prairie butterflies as well.
Oh, okay. All right. I would guess that wetland butterflies would be more in danger simply because we have a tendency to drain all of our wetlands and take them over, and that to some degree we're trying to restore prairies. Would that be inaccurate?
Well, prairie butterflies are doing at least as badly as
wetland
butterflies.
Oh, well, then I feel better. Okay.
I'm just being a ray of sunshine here. But
you ought to show up next week when we're talking about the end of the world, okay?
But realistically, most of the butterflies that require these tiny, tiny remnants of native habitat that have been so badly reduced here in Illinois are all struggling to one degree or another.
And what are the various reasons that's the case?
Well, the vast majority of it is frank habitat loss. You know, when mm-hmm. you've lost over 99.9% of the prairies, when you've lost over 90% of the wetlands, there just aren't that many places that these species require to live in remaining anymore. And so that's been a big problem. The other thing is the remaining pieces get kind of smaller and smaller and erode a bit around the edges. They become more vulnerable to floristic changes because they've become so small. And these things are also harmful to the butterflies. Insects tend to respond faster to these types of changes than plants do because, unlike most prairie and wetland plants, which are perennials, insects have to complete at least one round of their entire life cycle every year.
Mm.
And if plants have a bad year, they can not set seed for a year and, you know, they'll be relatively fine. They'll be able to bloom and set seed the following year. You can't do that with insects.
That's true. And you're echoing the sentiments of Doug Tallamy, who's written a book, Bringing Nature Home, and I've had on the program several times, and he's wanted all over the country people bring him in to speak because he has been talking about two of the things that you mentioned, and the first is habitat loss and biomass reduction in terms of our insects. And I read something, maybe it was something you wrote or somebody else did recently. No, I don't think it was you, but somebody was talking about butterflies and said, we're cool until people realize that they're insects, and then they get all wigged out about it. It's because people respond.
Even butterflies? People get wigged out about butterflies?
They do. Huh. I mean, isn't that strange? Yeah. Well, you know,
I remember as kids growing them, like on the back of our house, we had this north side of the house and it had like a little ridge and there were always cocoons out back and the whole back side of the house would be covered in them. And we would watch them waiting for them to is it a hatching? Are they hatching?
Emerge.
Yeah. And it was so much fun because I remember, you know, at first the caterpillars would crawl up and then they would cocoon themselves. And it was so much fun as a kid. And I don't think my nieces and nephews do that. I haven't seen that.
Well, you know,
that's
interesting because I go into garden talks and I ask this question. I say, when is it that we decided that insects are creepy? Do you need that to graduate from high school? Because kids love insects, for the most part, and then adults are creeped out by them. So where's the disconnect? Where does it occur?
I think it occurs when they come in the house.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you might be right.
I would say all the teenagers. Like my kids, my family are great with them until they become teenagers, and then there's some ew factor.
I think it's coolness.
I think last year I was picking up cicadas with my hands, and my nieces and nephews were like, oh, my God. I'm freaking out. Okay, that is an ugly bug, but still.
But
cool.
But it's something about peer pressure, I think. I don't know. And it's not necessary really to do a study on it, but it is necessary to change the way we think about insects.
I do wonder, though. I mean, this generation isn't necessarily outside gardening. They're not getting their hands dirty. They're not playing outside in the woods. I mean, when we were kids, we were, you know, the door was open in the morning. We were sent out and we were told there would be peanut butter sandwiches sitting on the picnic table around noon, but we weren't to come home until the sun went down.
Yeah.
If the street lights were on, we would go out and play. And
that's
not what kids do today. Kids are, you know, I think people are afraid of the dangerous things that might, you know, I don't know. Kids just don't, they're not sent out with those kinds of parameters anymore. I think
when they are sent out, they're sent out with a helmet and knee pads and elbow pads. Mm-hmm. And it's like, try to move, kid.
I do agree with helmets. I've had a concussion.
When you're looking for bugs?
No. When you're riding your bike.
Well, that's different. We're talking to Doug Tarin, who was a doctor. Doug Tarin, I should say. You're rolling your eyes. It's okay, but I should mention it, shouldn't I? You're a PhD.
You worked hard for it. Absolutely.
That's right. From the Peggy Notabart Nature Museum. You were telling me as we came in today that there's a butterfly you're working on right now that you're doing. Tell me about this.
Well, the butterfly we're working on right now is a prairie species called the regal fritillary. And this butterfly is just drop-dead gorgeous. It's about the size of a monarch. It's got some of the same orangey color that the monarch has, but it's got these beautiful blue-black hind wings. And it is in real trouble here in Illinois. It's down to just a couple of self-sustaining populations. It had populations here in the Chicago area up until probably the mid-1980s when the last of those winked out. And we have been trying to bring it back to the Indian boundary prairies down near Markham. And the way we do this is that we go out into the field to one of the remaining strong populations, collect a few females, get them to lay eggs in the laboratory, rear them up, and then release the adults to try to start a new population when they've grown up. It's a challenging species to work with because of the way they spend their winter. The females lay their eggs in September. The eggs hatch. The caterpillars eat the eggshells and then immediately go into hibernation. Mm. And so you've got these tiny, tiny, just tremendously vulnerable, millimeter-long caterpillars spending the winter. And they need to experience the winter cold.
So you can't take them indoors and say, hey, don't worry, we'll take care of you, because that's the wrong thing to do.
It is. You could do that. And the result of doing that would be that you would have adult butterflies in February. And then what do you do?
Yeah.
We have tried to devise ways of bringing them over the winter. Refrigerators are not terribly good to do this with because they dry things out terribly.
Mm-hmm.
So we have experimented with different types of wintering cages on the museum roof. And we've had some success, but our success is not as reproducible as we would like. So we've set up a more formal experiment this winter with statistical sampling and very defined parameters that we're testing. And tomorrow we're going to be hoping that we can wake at least some of these caterpillars up and start feeding them in the lab to get them ready to release later this spring.
And you've done that with also the swamp metal mark.
We've also worked in the laboratory with the swamp metal mark. We actually had our first field release of adult swamp metal marks just this past late August.
Yeah, I saw the article. You sent me an article, and I appreciate that. And I linked to it at MikeNovak.net. Go to this week's show, and when you're reading up about Doug Tarin, you released, 20 of them, right, in Elgin?
Well, we released 20 on the day that the article was written.
Oh, okay.
Fortunately, we were able, over the course of the next week or so, to release more than that. All told, we released about 60, which is still a very small number. But
really, in the scheme of things, you think, how can that even have an impact at all?
Well, one of the nice things about working with insects is that females produce a very large number of eggs. So, for example, when you're working in the laboratory, you can really expand populations rapidly. In nature, only a small percentage of these survive. We're hopeful that the small numbers that we've released makes the limited number of targets for predators there such that they'll have a little better chance of reproducing on site and getting a population started. But, of course, it is such small numbers that we've been working with that we will be doing this again for at least one more year just to try to get the genetics up to something a bit more reasonable.
And then go back to the fen, which is a Bluff Spring fen in Elgin, and then search for the progeny of the ones you released?
Yes. We will be going out starting in the next couple of weeks and looking at the host plants to see if we can see any feeding damage. That's fairly easy to find with this species, and that way we won't have to wait until June or July to see if any adults have made it through. Of course, we'll be looking then, too.
And one of the things that fascinates me in reading up on it, your blog and the articles, is that you keep trying different stuff. You're learning every day about how to keep, you'll try one thing with an insect and then a bunch of them die. So, okay, that's not working. Let's try something new and let's do this. And as you talk about, how do you help them over winter because they need the cold? That is a painstaking process, is it not?
It's actually, for me, the most exciting part about this is I'm not just following a recipe here, that there's a lot to be learned. This is an emerging field, and so that makes it very exciting. It makes it very rewarding when things do finally work. But to a large extent, we are making this up as we go along. We're, taking very careful records of things and keeping track of what works and what doesn't. We're trying to bring a more formal experimental approach to certain aspects of it. But you're entirely right. Keeping stuff over the winter is the hardest step in the whole process.
It's the same with plants, actually, because I've seen this before where somebody has a plant, it just gets started in the fall, and it's a plant that likes to overwinter, but they didn't get it into the ground. And they say, well, okay, what do I do with it now? Can I put it in my basement? Well, if it doesn't go into dormancy, that can be an issue. And then when you bring it out in the spring, that can be an issue too. And how many months can you sustain a plant that is craving dormancy and not getting it? How long can you do that? And I imagine it's the same thing with insects.
It is. And we actually have to do something similar with plants because right around the first of the month, we had violets that we had potted up outside. That's the plant that the regal fritillary caterpillars eat.
Mm.
And so we had to bring them into the lab, get them to break dormancy and start growing so we'd have something to feed the caterpillars this week when we wake them up.
Let me ask you something. Violets, the same ones that people use herbicides on in their backyards, or different kinds of violets?
In the wild, they use different species of violets.
Okay.
It's a combination of having the violet there and the vegetative structure that they need means that the species that people are killing in their backyards aren't what they're using in the wild. The good news for us is they can use that species in the laboratory, so that makes it a little bit easier for us to get plant material for them.
That is Doug Tarin speaking. He is the butterfly guy, but it's not on his license plate yet. From Peggy Notabart Nature Museum, I want to let people know, we've got a few minutes if you want to ask a quick question about butterflies, 773-763-9278. Carrie is waiting, standing by, to get your calls. The question I'm going to ask you now, you don't need to answer right now unless you've got it at the top of your head, because I did promote this as your State of the Butterflies presentation. If you had one word to describe the state of the butterflies, or two words or a phrase, what would it be? Now, you don't have to answer right now if you don't quite have it, but if you do, great. But otherwise, think about that until the end of the segment here, and okay. I will have you make that pronouncement. Let us talk about Monarch real quick. You've actually visited their overwintering grounds in Mexico.
Yes, I've actually been to two of the different reserves where the monarchs cluster in previous years, at least, in just the tens of millions in the Oymel fir trees there. And I can't imagine. It's not only can one not imagine, it's really difficult to explain or express or convey to anybody just what it's like to be there. I put pictures up on my blog, and it just strikes me as totally inadequate every time I look at them.
I don't really have a bucket list, but if I had an actual bucket list that was written down, that would be on it, because I just can't imagine the beauty that it is and the delicacy. And I mean, I just see those images and it's breathtaking.
It is breathtaking, and it's one of the things that you get there, and it lives up to expectations.
Because they're so magical. I don't know what it is about a butterfly that is just magical.
I don't know either, but it is. I mean, that's...
The last time I was there, I was with a bunch of, you know, very formal scientists who work with the monarch from all over the country and all over Mexico. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you think that you're with all of these professionals who have seen it all and are used to it. And about 15 minutes after we got up to the part of the sanctuary, the monarchs, where they're actually roosting, I realized that everybody was whispering. And you don't need to. They can't hear.
Butterflies don't mind sound.
They don't mind sound, but it was...
Do butterflies have ears?
No.
No, so they...
They can't even hear.
They can't hear, but I imagine they feel vibration.
They can feel vibration, sure, very, very well. But it was like being in church. It really was. Uh-huh. It was...
There's a reverence.
There was a reverence. You were witnessing this just magnificent natural phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And I get goosebumps just thinking back to it.
I felt something similar in Costa Rica. I was in Monteverde, which is a sanctuary and a habitat there. And we were there kind of late in the fall, so... there weren't a lot of butterflies there. Maybe I don't know what their periods are, but there was one that was sitting on my shoulder that was bigger than my hand. I had never seen, I don't remember what kind of a butterfly it was. My Spanish, that wasn't in my Spanish class, surprisingly, butter translation. It was remarkable. And yeah, we whispered the whole time we were there. Yeah. Granted, there were also, we were looking for sloths and we were looking for, lots of other things. And so you can't be a big, loud, clumsy oaf when you're stumbling around in the woods, but it was remarkable sitting in the, being out in a rainforest and having these land.
Here's the problem. At their peak, which it was apparently 1996, the monarchs occupied nearly 45 acres of land and their overwintering area. This past winter, it shrank. This is writing in the New York Times. This is an article in the New York Times that was published in December. The overwintering monarch shrank last month to a bare 1.65 acres, the equivalent of about 1.25 football fields. That's what's left of the monarch population.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, no, in fairness, 1996 was a remarkably large year.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
If you look at the population data going back into the 1980s, 1996 sticks out like a sore thumb.
Okay.
It has also not been a steady, inexorable decline. These numbers tend to jump up and down from year to year.
But the last few years it has been.
The last few years have been
precipitous. Is
very bad, and I think precipitous is a reasonable word there. But it's easy to make things sound really alarming when, in fact, things are simply very alarming.
So on the gradient.
Oh, well, there we go.
I'll sleep well
tonight. Yeah. All right, well, let's take a quick phone call before we let you go. Let's go to the phones. And Catherine, you're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I love the subject. I love your show.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I have a field in the back about approximately an acre, and I specifically put it out there for all the pollinators and the bees. But every fall, I cut it down, so hoping the seed would come down and it would improve the field every year. Am I taking away the eggs of the monarchs? I always thought the monarchs came out and then went to Mexico every fall.
Well, it might not be the monarchs, but I think Doug will have an opinion about this.
Well, first of all, you're not taking away the eggs of the monarchs. Because you're quite correct. They do go down to Mexico every fall, and none of their life stages are up here for the winter. If you are cutting the stuff down and not taking it away, that's probably not too much of a problem if it's just lying there on the ground, because the eggs of things will just continue on as they would have. If you are actually clearing the vegetation and taking things away and putting them, say, in your compost pile or something like that, you may be removing immature stages from some of the insects that you might want to have around in the field.
No, I leave it sitting there because I'm hoping the seed will stay, and every year I'll keep improving on more milkweed and more milkweed and more wildflowers.
Well, then you're pretty much leaving what needs to be there, so that's good news.
What about all this burning that I see in all the fields around the areas and the forest preserves? Wouldn't burning then hurt it?
Burning's a really interesting question, and one of these things that's very much a double-edged sword. On one hand, prairies and a lot of the natural areas here around northern Illinois and over much of the country need to burn. It is part of what they require to be good, healthy ecosystems. There are guidelines that people use that allow them to burn in ways that will not damage butterfly populations. This is something that's actually been studied a fair bit. And as long as people are burning on a certain rotation, it seems to be compatible with good butterflies.
Great.
Thank you, Catherine. Great questions. I appreciate it. And keep
Thanks,
up the good
Mike.
Work. We appreciate that, too.
Love you and your show. I learn a lot.
Oh, I appreciate that, too. I'm appreciating everything. All right. I'll talk to you later. Have a great Sunday.
Bye-bye.
Before I let you go, Doug, one of the things you mentioned to me, we had a little phone chat before the show, and it's about the loss of habitat and one of the reasons we're losing habitat. Talking about monarchs, they don't have milkweed anymore. I think it's unfortunate that it's called weed, milkweed. I think it should be called monarch plant, and we should change the name right now because, labeling and marketing, branding is everything. But as you pointed out to me, that's part of the problem is that we're losing it. What is going on?
Well, there have been some recent changes in agricultural practices that have appeared to reduce the amount of milkweed that's present here in the upper Midwest. Some of the new technologies around corn production have allowed much more extensive use of herbicides on the cornfields. The corn plants themselves are resistant to these herbicides.
So they can use them with impunity because it's not going to kill the corn plant, so let's throw some more herbicide out there.
And I don't think anybody really fully appreciated the degree to which monarchs might have been using milkweed inside of these agricultural fields. People are aware of it on the edges of the ag fields and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the current hypothesis is that the decline may be linked to this reduction in milkweed on the interior of agricultural fields.
You mean within fields?
Within fields, yes.
Rather than the rows, the hedgerows.
Right. Actually growing in between the rows of corn.
Uh-huh. Oh, my goodness. And now, without getting into unsubstantiated theories, some people think it's the GMOs in the corn that might be causing some problems.
Well, it's the GMOs in corn are allowing this type of agricultural practice to be done. The GMOs in the corn aren't probably not, directly harming the monarchs themselves. They are allowing this change that is reducing their host plant.
All right, Doug, what do you advise people to do if they want to help? Obviously, plant wildflowers, flowers that our butterflies love. What else can they do?
Well, there's a big push to have people include milkweed and plantings in their gardens and in their yards. And that's certainly, at the very least, not going to harm the monarchs. And if enough people do it, it may actually help to reverse some of this trend.
Unfortunately, the city of Chicago has been giving out tickets for milkweed and they have to change. It just has to change.
And this is something else that I think people can do is to really work to change that. Milkweed is not a weed. Milkweed, there are some beautiful garden varieties of it if you don't like the coarser look of common milkweed. And the nice thing is all of the species of milkweed are perfectly good host plants for the monarch.
Well, let's petition the city. Let's start at change.org.
There are people working on, you know, change.org might not be a bad thing. I mean, Kathy Cummings, who has been on the show and, you know, is fighting this. You're nodding, so you know her. Yes. A lot of people know her. She's working very hard at this, and I am in contact with her. In fact, she's got a lawsuit that is wending its way through the legal system.
Yeah, we haven't gotten an update on that lately.
No, we need to do that, and we will.
I get her emails, but I haven't seen anything.
Doug Tarin, thank you so much for being here. And your word for the state of the butterflies is?
Mostly not bad. It's a few species that are in trouble. And I do think it's important to recognize that the majority of butterfly species are doing fine. Some of these specialized cases are in real trouble, but we don't want to lose them.
And we don't. So let's try harder. Thank you so much for being here. We have to do it again sooner than the last time.
Thanks a lot. It's been great.
In the Green Room.
Yiddick.
In the Green Room with Mike has been brought to you by Christy Weber Landscapes at ChristyWeber.com, right in your own backyard.
Hi, my name is Peggy, and I don't want you to be left out. Here's what I'm talking about. Each month, more people turn to Natural Awakening Chicago to improve their lives than any other health or wellness magazine. If you're a green, natural health, or wellness business, you should be part of the leading sustainability resource in the country, Natural Awakening. Hi, my name is Peggy, and I don't want you to be left out. Here's what I'm talking about. Each month, more people turn to Natural Awakening Chicago to improve their lives than any other health or wellness magazine. If you're a green, natural health, or wellness business, you should be part of the leading sustainability resource in the country. Natural Awakenings is packed with information that our readers use to find the products and services they need to live happier, healthier lives. Natural Awakenings is available for free each month throughout the city and north and northwest suburbs. We're placed in more than 1,100 area locations, ensuring the right eyes read about your products and services. We're also online at nachicagonorth.com. We're local, we're independent, and our readers will help you grow your business. Call us today at 847-858-3697 to learn more. That's 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good, live simply, laugh more.
Is pain keeping you from enjoying gardening? Dr. Bonnie Flaster at River North Wellness Center has gentle and effective techniques to get you out of pain and back to doing what you love. Here are two quick tips. First, remember to stretch. Second, use a timer to make sure you take breaks. Come see her at River North Wellness Center and find more tips at rivernorthwellness.com or call 312-642-7545 to make an appointment with Dr. Flaster and get back to feeling good.
You can have a beautiful landscape and be kind to the environment for great growing results. You should try Milorganite organic nitrogen fertilizer. And whoops, the bell is entangled. No, it's not. I'm glad to have them back on the show this season. Its slow release goof-proof formula provides consistent feeding, and it's safe for your children and pets. Whether you're a seasoned or novice gardener, trust the fertilizer that's been proven effective for over 85 years. Use Milorganite in all your lawn and garden needs, anywhere you want good things to grow. Milorganite, for better results naturally. Visit Milorganite.com, MILORGANITE.com, to find a garden center near you. Sunny day. What are you talking about here? I got up this morning and there was snow on the ground, Rick DeMaio. What the heck is going on?
Yeah, well, you remember you got to pay me extra for these 5-month long winters, Mike.
Wow. This is, and it did it last week. You know, it's kind of the same thing. This little layer of little dusting of snow just from because.
Yeah, but the stuff that happened last week was totally different. That was just a large scale storm system kind of snuck up here from the south and gave us a little, you know, northern edge of this stuff. This snow was all lake effect. It was 110% lake effect. If you run outside and grab a little bit of that snow off the top of a car, put it into a bottle, let it melt, you can drink it, and you have literally pure Lake Michigan water. Isn't that an amazing thing about the hydrologic?
That's crazy.
Yeah, it is. At least it really is an amazing process. And we could have had a bunch more of these setups, I should say a bunch more of the results, due to the fact that the setup was there, just that the lake was covered with ice. And all of a sudden we lose the ice. And what does it do? It goes, okay, I'm a liquid again. I'm going to become a gas and then become a cloud and become a snowflake and become a nuisance.
Well, you know, we've had so much of it this winter. Who cares?
Well, you know what? It's amazing, though. Oh, by the way, in regards to the butterflies and the population dwindling, I'm having margarine this morning on my bagel, so I'm doing whatever I can to keep the butterfly population.
You're eating margarine?
Yeah, instead of butter. Yeah.
Oh boy!
How is that good? I lost
no,
it. That,
that's no. It's just one of Rick's jokes. Okay.
Oh, it was.
It's okay. Just one. Just what? Wait.
Yeah, I'm having the margarine. Instead. Okay.
All right.
Good. Thank you, Rick.
Sorry, Rick. Yeah, I'm slow.
Hit the muffled cymbal, Mike.
Wait. But you know, actually, okay. As long as you're going down that road, I get to play
real butter
flies.
Yeah, what was that really bad commercial with William Shatner telling you the exact type of oil in the promised margarine, whatever that thing was? Remember that? He did that thing for years.
No,
I don't.
So his agent got him a commercial to talk about spread, I guess what they called it back then. Yeah, the world of actors out of work in their 60s, they'll do anything. But it was amazing because last night I'm walking the dog and I'm like, wow, there's actually clouds developing over the lake. I knew we'd get something, and the wind was out of the northeast. I'm like, this isn't right. And then 3:30 this morning, I wake up, look out the window. There was nothing. The moon was out. 6:30, I wake up, and I'm like, what is that? And sure enough, an inch and a half of snow. I called the weather service, and they go, we were waiting for your phone call. I love that. I go, has it gotten to that point? I go, well, yes and no, but we needed to have some sort of confirmation about what's going on. And sure enough, I snapped a couple of pictures and emailed it to them. And they were like, wow, an inch and a half. And they said, well, we're going for 2 inches by 8 o'clock. I'm like, you're more than halfway there. So I provided them with some, you know, well-needed eyes along the lakefront. But what's interesting is, you know, with now all the ice gone, you can actually see the lake level of where it is now, and it is down. It is like I predicted it would be from this winter's, you know, cold, even though we had ice on it. Mike, it's down easily, I'd say about 8 to 10 inches lower than it was last year at this time.
All right, please explain that one more time, because as you've said, when the sun's rays are reflected, it's supposed to suppress evaporation, and yet the lake is lower. Why is that?
Well, that's how much the sun rays. It's the air mass itself, and the air has been incredibly cold, November, December, even into January, and most of February. I'd say half of February, Lake Michigan was largely ice-free. You had a lot of ice along the shoreline, but the middle of the lake really never really froze up until about late February, then it refroze again about late March. So it's almost like you take saran wrap and you cover, you know, only the edges of a pie, and you leave the middle of it open, it's going to dry out. And that's essentially what happened. The lake literally dried out due to evaporation, and each time it did it, it formed clouds and precipitation. So oddly enough, Lake Superior, which is still about 80% frozen over, only because their ice was a lot thicker, it's kind of chunkier, they got a lot of snow on top of it. Marquette, Michigan is down 30 inches this year from their normal snowfall due to the fact that they've had so much ice on that lake, it froze over really early and it literally shut off their lake effect snow machine. While places downwind of Lake Ontario still getting pounded, and even areas just to the south and east of us over in Michigan have gotten quite a bit of snow. So now the lake is open, and then you have this incredibly cold air mass, which is really more so like a January air mass. I mean, this thing is really impressive at this time of the year. And sure enough, lake effect snow ends, and then we have a sunny day upon us with a lot of cold air for the rest of the week.
Amazing. You also sent me information that is pretty interesting. Soil temperatures at 4-inch depth under bare soil at the Botanic Garden. and then 4-inch underside.
Yeah, and I think it was quite amazing, Mike. As much snow that we've had, those temperatures are still in the lower 40s, and that's pretty good. And that's, I think, reminiscent of the fact that even though we've been cold, we've had a lot of sun. So as soon as the ground actually did begin to lose some of its snow cover, which we did about a week and a half ago, we were able to warm up the soils. I think they're in like the lower 40s. Now, I'm not a soil temperature expert, so I don't know where this stands from what should be this time of the year. I do know that we were a lot warmer this time last year. And certainly in 2012, when the temperature 2 days ago was 87 degrees, that's when we had five consecutive days of 80. That was just one of those winters that rewrote the record books.
Well, I remember this one.
We played volleyball.
This one rewrote the record books too.
In a different way.
Yeah.
And then Europe just finished a week where they had temperatures in the upper 70s and lower 80s. So there was this large mass of warm air that kind of got jutted northward from, say, northern sections of Africa. Parts of Germany had temperatures around, I think last I looked, it was 26 degrees centigrade, which is about 78, 79 degrees, somewhere in that range. Really, really warm stuff. And yet here we are still cold and getting colder. It really is quite phenomenal. And then on top of that, you have this massive area of warm, dry air out over the Rocky Mountains into the Pacific Northwest and California. And this went largely unreported, Mike, but we've had two dust storms with winds up to 50, 60 miles an hour and half-mile visibilities across Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas, and eastern Colorado, which is due to the fact that they have an ongoing drought in that area. It's really amazing.
It is, and you're right. It has been underreported. I did see something about it. And I will say very quickly before we get into the forecast that in my own backyard, if I'm in the sunny area, because my yard's on the north side of my house, so some of it's shaded. So in the sunny area, I have to get my thermometer out there, and I'll get a temperature for you. But I can tell you that in the shady area, it's frozen solid. It's still frozen. Mm-hmm. The soil is still frozen solid. So what do we got coming up this week?
Yeah, and I think that's going to be the key thing is how much we can actually thaw out the soil. So in the last 30 seconds that we have, sunshine today, only mid-20s, mid upper 20s tomorrow with a little bit of cloudiness in the morning, and then maybe the possibility of 1 to 2 inches of snow Monday night into Tuesday, and then it remains cold right through the end of the week. There is absolutely no chance of seeing temperatures even above 40 degrees for the next 7 days. So I think it'll be great next week. We could talk to someone who knows a little bit more about soil temperatures. We can get kind of a gauge of where we are and where we're going to be.
You know, that would be a good thing. Maybe I can get, I have to talk to Jennifer Brennan because she always keeps track of the soil temperatures in regard to plants. And so maybe we can do that.
And that's what you think, Mike, with this year with soil compaction, without a doubt.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Rick DeMaio. Have a great week. Cold temperatures. We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
All right. Bye-bye. Wow, that's not particularly encouraging if you're a gardener. In the second hour, something else that's not too encouraging is that we're polluting our skies with too much light. I hope you'll stick around for that.
This hour of the Mike Novak Show is brought to you by Recycled Granite, featuring eco-friendly split stone veneers and handmade products by individuals with disabilities. Go to recycledgranite.com. Here he is again, Mike Novak.
Bet you didn't know I could pick it that well. This last week, you might remember that I had seen this group. They're called Sunnyside Up. And they were at the... Oh, my goodness. Look. Oh, my goodness. Oh, we need a camera here. Okay. I got interrupted by this because I've...
There's
also
a cake.
I wish we had a camera here.
We're not filming like on free... What's it called again? What's that?
Free cell?
Stephanie
no.
Miller does it all.
On Free Speech TV.
Free Speech TV.
Yeah. Well, no. We're not the big time here. We're just a little tiny little radio show here. But our guest Audrey Fisher She warned me she was going to bring in some stuff.
Well, she brought in a lot of stuff.
This is... You can't believe this. Okay,
well,
we're going to get the other part?
Oh, yeah,
there's more? Where's my camera? I got to take a photo of this. And we're going to post this on Facebook immediately. It is cookies. Did you see this, Carrie? You can't believe this. This is cookies that say The Mike Novak Show, and each cookie has its own letter. This is just unbelievable. You saw this, Kerr.
Yes, I did see the cookies.
Are these homemade?
No.
Sit down, both of you. Audrey Fisher is here, who's the director of the Chicago Astronomical Society. Mark Hammergren, is that how you pronounce it, Mark?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And he's astronomer and director of the Astroscience Workshop at the Adler Planetarium. You've thrown me for a loop here, Audrey, okay?
Oh, no.
It's... Hey, had I known you were going to come, I'd have baked a cake.
It's heavy.
Oh, my goodness. Wait. All right, All right, folks, we're taking a photo here. No. We got to get this photo here because don't mind me. It's only radio, but I have to do... Oh, I want to get you in there, too. Okay, oh, my... My goodness. That is unbelievable. Okay, now I also have to get a shot of the cookies here. You guys talk amongst yourselves here oh, my goodness. I have to get a shot of this. I've never seen anything.
Did you describe what we have here?
Well, not the cake.
Well, the cake. Oh, my gosh. The cake.
Describe the cookies.
It's an atomic cake. So lots of
what is in there? So the cake on the top, it's beautiful rainbow color. It's just absolutely beautiful. And it says everything green under the stars.
Under the sun.
Under the sun.
And stars.
Wow.
It's beautiful.
I have to send this to somebody so that I can post on Facebook. I'll tell you what, you can
post. No, just you can post on Facebook from your phone.
I know I can, but I also have a radio show that I'm supposed to be doing.
Pass or buy.
I can set it up for you.
I know. I have the same phone.
Oh, well then post that sucker. Post that on Facebook right now. Wow. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Let me finish the thought. I was playing this music, and I think it's still there someplace. Oh, it just ended there. Okay. By a group called Sunny Side Up. They were at the Good Food Festival last week, and I heard them play, and they rocked the house. And I said, I'm going to play some of that on my show. And that was it, because I got a CD, and I wanted to make sure that I did. And it's, let's see, it's Sunny Side Up is Colby Maddox, Mike Church, and Steve Hartley. I believe you can go to www.sunnysideupmusic.com. And they feature a mandolin, fiddle, acoustic guitar, upright bass, tambourine, and it actually pretty simple. But they were doing some Rolling Stones music that was just out of sight. It was really, really cool. So, I can't wait till we get this, the cookie parade up on Facebook. Have you had a chance to put that up there, Lisa, or are you taking more photos?
No, I'm going to take a quick picture of Audrey and Mark.
Okay. And then we can get to the real show here. And my apologies for you folks listening. I'm so stunned by this thing that showed up and that's staring at me right now.
Yes. But I am very excited because this is a topic that I know Audrey and I met in August through the Climate Reality Project with Al Gore. And I know this is something that she is completely passionate about and that keeps her up at night and that drives her focus and energy during the day.
Well, you said keeps her up at night and keeps a lot of people up at night, doesn't it?
True.
I mean, and that's kind of the truth, isn't it?
Through worry and concern. And I think I think that she brings a voice to this topic that is often ignored or just not even... Like, I don't think it's not even a matter of ignoring it, but just a matter of not even knowing that this is a problem. And I think that she's a great voice for that.
Some of us have intuited it in the past, have felt that we were losing something. I mean, I can tell you, for me, when I was a kid, for a long time, I thought I was going to be an astronomer. All right. And I was the kind of kid who I couldn't point out all of the constellations, but I could show you quite a few and impress you. Oh, that's Vega up there in Lyra, you know, and, you know, oh, there's the Pleiades. And, you know, I got to go boom, 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 boom. And, you know, it's a neat parlor trick. All right. And then I got to college and I took my first astronomy course and I realized how much math was involved, and that was kind of the end of that. I'm not horrible at math, but I don't have a passion for it. And I think sometimes you have to have. Although there are astronomers, and Mark Hammergren, maybe you can tell me about this since you work at the Adler Planetarium. There are astronomers who don't follow the math route. They are the observers, the ones. There's a lot of amateur astronomers out there, and they look at the skies and they chart things and they discover things. It's still a world, even with satellites in space, where the average astronomer, if he works hard or she works hard enough, can find something, correct?
That's absolutely the case. And I think one of the best examples of this kind of work is not just the observational astronomers, the folks out there with their telescopes, but anybody on the internet connecting to the Adler and working with our Zooniverse programs, programs like Galaxy Zoo, Planet Zoo, Planet Hunters, and soon coming out Asteroid Zoo. This is where individuals can just log in and join into various astronomical research projects, just ordinary people.
And that is – it's one of the few – areas, I think, in science where people, the average person, can participate. Why, is that because the cosmos is so large that we can't possibly watch all of it, even the professionals?
That's part of the reason. There are so many subjects out there in the skies. But another part of that is that amateur astronomy has an incredibly rich history stretching back many centuries, of course, just like amateur science in general.
Mm-hmm.
So we have that incredible foundation that's been built up over centuries.
And, of course, the first amateur astronomer was Galileo.
yes,
I suppose.
Well, and professional, because he was paid for his his work by his patrons.
But he got in a lot of trouble for that, too, you know.
Yes.
We wouldn't get in the same kind of trouble today. Because I was this kid who would go out, I would hear there's a meteor shower. I go out in the backyard, and this is in the suburbs of Detroit in the late 50s, early 60s, and sit out there freezing my derriere in the cold and the dew, looking up at the sky to see how many shooting stars I could see, or watch a lunar eclipse at 2 a.m. or, you know, whatever. And as an adult, I became aware that I couldn't see those things anymore. I live in Chicago. I've been here for 30 years, and the one time I had a house in the Pacific Northwest for about 17 years, and I talk about it on the show occasionally. It was on the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State.
Oh, yes, indeed.
There's very little light there.
Yeah.
And even though I was surrounded by 300-foot tall conifers, I could see more stars there in the one little gap that we had than I can see in Chicago. And I could actually see the Milky Way.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing feeling. And too many of us don't see the stars anymore. We have to describe what the Milky Way is to people because they've never seen it.
And people just don't—they don't get it. They don't understand what it looks like. There's a pretty famous story. It goes back to 1994. The Northridge earthquake in L.A. knocked a bunch of power out in the early morning hours. And so the skies above L.A. were dark. People looked up, and they flooded the emergency response centers with calls about the eerie silver cloud that was hanging in the sky. And they were told, this is the Milky Way. People are so disconnected from the night sky nowadays that they just have this misconception of what a dark sky looks like.
I read a science fiction tale, because I was also a big science fiction buff, a story about a planet with a double sun.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was never darkness. And then a confluence happens, an alignment where there was an eclipse and everything for the first time in the history of the planet or the history of that race, everything goes dark and the stars pop out. And they weren't on the spiral arm of their galaxy the way we are here in our solar system, but in the center of the galaxy. And suddenly all these stars pop up and everybody sees them, and it chaos ensues and the people go mad, and the planet, you know, is destroyed. That has struck me. The story you just told is something like that, though not on such a grand scale and an absurd scale.
And typically the emotions are quite the opposite when people see a starry sky. Uh-huh. And, you know, people go on vacations to do this. And you talk to anyone. In my job as an astronomer, and I talk to people about the night sky, joining on star parties and things like that. You talk to people, and one of the first things they'll say is, you know, I remember, you know, when I was out in the North Woods of Wisconsin, there were so many stars out there. But that's a, you know, common response. People, you start talking to people.
There were so many stars out there. They're always there, folks. That's the point.
Indeed.
They are always there. And part of our problem is that we really haven't paid attention to where we're pointing our lights, our city lights. And I'm one of those guys, when I see these photographs from space of the planet at night and I see all the light, I'm not impressed. I'm terrified. I look at that and I go, holy smoke, what are we doing to ourselves? And this is a serious problem. Audrey, you're the one who brought this to my attention. How is it you got involved in this?
Well, goodness, everyone should take a look at that satellite view of Earth at night. And it's actually called the Black Marble, put out by NASA. And it versus the blue marble, which is everybody else is more familiar with. Mm-hmm. But you'll see how the globe is illuminated at night with streetlights, literally. And that's what's preventing us from seeing the stars. The National Park Service has already warned us that by 2025, 90% of the population in America will never see a starry night sky even once in their lifetime. Now,
what year was that?
By 2025.
Wow.
So, and the latest predictions now with municipalities changing over to the bright white LEDs, we're worried that it's going to happen even sooner.
Let's talk about that. Transition. At one point, we had mercury vapor lights. Then we graduated to sodium vapor lights. And now we're going to LEDs. What? I don't know if you guys understand the engineering behind this, but what did each of those steps bring about?
Well, to me, what type of light isn't as important as what color spectrum that we use. And what we're finding out is that the big push with the LED lights is efficiency. Unfortunately, they're super efficient in the high blue spectrum, which scatters more, which will definitely increase our sky glow by at least five times, or up to five times, which is quite a bit, 500% over the city of Chicago.
But this is a problem because LEDs are more efficient, and that's where we're going. This is not going to change. So how do we address the issue?
Balance. Just like if we were only focused with efficiency with the automobile, for example, we would have the super lightest weight. We'd make our cars out of styrofoam because they're so lightweight and they'd make it efficient. However, no, we're concerned with safety.
No, but you can't recycle styrofoam, so that's,
that's a bad example.
Okay. Well, except the styrofoam manufacturers will tell you, oh, yeah, you can recycle. It's 100% recyclable, except that nobody in the country does it. So that's the problem.
So we're just saying that, we have to balance our needs. Efficiency is a great thing, but it's only one thing to factor in. The environment is something else to factor in, as well as safety. And when we get David Blask on, he'll be able to explain more of the the biological rhythms that are disconnected by this light pollution at night.
Well, as if on cue, let us bring in Dr. David Blask. David, are you with us?
I'm with you.
Dr. Blask is professor of structural and cellular biology at the Department of Structural and Cellular Biology, Tulane University School of Medicine, and the Tulane Cancer Center. Perhaps you would like to address what Audrey is talking about here. What kind of physical reaction do we have to this incessant light?
Well, Audrey is exactly right. We do respond to light in very important ways. Of course, we're most we can most relate to light during the day, especially full spectrum sunlight, and that when on a non-cloudy day when we can see the blue sky on a bright sunny day, that's really good for us. And what it does is helps to cue our what we call our biological rhythms. And these biological rhythms run about 24 hours every day in our behavior and our physiology and our metabolism. And those rhythms are called circadian rhythms, meaning about a day. And those rhythms are generated by a particular clock in the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And that clock needs to be reset every day. It's not a perfect clock. And the sunshine during the day does that, resets the clock. So it's very helpful to have bright, full-spectrum blue skies during the day. However, the situation at night is the total opposite. We evolved to see total darkness during the night. So before the advent of the light bulb, 130 years ago, something like that, we had very bright full-spectrum days and very dark nights. And this was perfect for assuring that the timing of our biology was appropriate so that we maintained a healthful status. Now, with so much artificial light at night in our 24-hour, 7-day-a-week society, we've literally flipped that evolutionary heritage. So now we see relatively dim light during the day because we're cooped up inside in offices, see very little sunshine. And then at night, we see bright light because most of us work into the night. And this is becoming more and more prevalent. People are on their iPads and their computers and watching TV and are seeing light at a time that they shouldn't be seeing light. And that can have a tremendous impact in disrupting this biological timing mechanism, which is so important for our health. And as a result, we're finding through studies that primarily look at shift workers, people who work night shifts, that several disease states increase in terms of their risk, including cancers, cardiovascular disease, metabolic diseases such as type 2 diabetes and obesity.
That's interesting because my brother-in-law for 20 years was a night cop and worked night shift. And actually his doctor said, you know what, you've done this long enough. You need to switch to days. This is too long to be in that cycle because his sleeping patterns were so irregular. And so because he was a dad, so he's like coaching baseball and doing those kinds of dad things during the day and then working at night. And they said that it was having an impact on his body.
I can attest to that because back when I was at Gargantua Radio down the dial, I did a lot of overnights there, and it would be like 3, 4, 5 days in a row where you're defeating your regular cycle or pushing the limit of it. And then you come home at 5 a.m., you get the sleep at 7 or 8, and you wake up at 2 in the afternoon, and you feel like you've been hit with a ball-peen hammer. Now, that's not to say that people can't get in. Well, actually, that's a question for you, Dr. Blask, is Does anybody ever get used to that, working overnight?
Well, there may be some people that can adapt. However, the studies that I'm aware of really indicate that that's rare. Even people who work permanent nights versus people who work rotating night shifts, where you would expect their schedule to be such that their clock is always chasing the change in their work shift and their exposure to light or darkness. You expect them to be discombobulated, but you'd think that in permanent night shift workers, that they would adapt, that their day just flips with their night. And your circadian system, your biological timing system, is quite adaptable in that way and could do that. You can do that with animals in the experimental setting where you have very strict control of the light-dark cycle. However, even permanent night shift workers don't adapt for the most part. And so they're just as screwed up as people who are working night shifts to the best of our knowledge. And a lot of that has to do with people when they come home during the day want to spend time with their family, so there's a social thing, and they may not sleep in a very dark room. If you're going to sleep during the day and you're a night shift worker, you have to be in a totally dark room in order for your circadian system to adapt. So the answer is most people don't adapt.
And you'd say it results in health problems. How can you, how is it you can tie those health problems to the lack of light or light at the wrong time or darkness? I thought your description was pretty amazing, because I hadn't thought of it this way either, is that we lock ourselves into dark rooms during the day and then we expose ourselves to bright light at night. That's really flipping things around, and it's really got to screw us up. So what's the correlation? How is it you guys have been able to measure this, Dr. Blask?
Well, there are a group of scientists who are called epidemiologists, and they study basically the incidence of disease in populations, and it can be any disease, of course, and try to connect an increased risk or incidence of disease with certain factors in the environment or genetic factors, so on. And doesn't really matter. And colleagues of mine who work in this area, most notably Richard Stevens and at the University of Connecticut, and Jani Hansen from Denmark, Scott Davis up in Seattle, Washington, the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center, they've done really elegant work, and others, many others. This has really caught on. Basically, to sort of summarize it all, there's no really good way to measure this phenomenon in human beings. So what they've done is they have looked at night shift workers and to see if, in fact, if you work night shifts, is there an increase in the incidence or risk of a particular disease? And they studied cancer, and mostly breast cancer. And they found that night shift workers have a significantly higher risk of developing breast cancer. And you may ask, well, why? How is this linked to light? Well, night shift work involves obviously exposure to light at night at various durations and intensities and spectra. So night shift work is considered a surrogate for exposure to light at night. That's the best you can do in a human population, and this seems to hold in the majority of studies. And the data are probably strongest in breast cancer, but it's turning out that prostate cancer in men is not far behind, that men who work night shifts have a significantly increased risk of prostate cancer, developing prostate cancer, and other cancers now, such as colon cancer, pancreatic cancer, lung cancer, even bladder cancer, and some lymphomas are. We're starting to see in some of these studies there's an increased risk. So it's not limited, seems to be not limited to breast cancer. So this is more widespread kind of phenomenon. And then and a person like myself takes these data, and then we try to look at this experimentally in the laboratory, in laboratory animals that have these tumors, and we can subject them to light at night to see is tumor growth accelerating, so on and so forth. And the animal studies really bear out what you see in the epidemiological studies.
Wow. That's mind-blowing, as they say. That is Dr. David Blask from Tulane University School of Medicine. Also with me today are Mark Hammergren, who's also a doctor, a PhD, astronomer, and director of the Astroscience Workshop at the Adler Planetarium, and Audrey Fisher, director of the Chicago Astronomical Society, and the founder and co-chair of One Star at a Time Global Star Park Network. All right, we're going to get back to this conversation. I see Dave has already called in. Dave, we will get to your phone call. If you have other questions, 773-763-9278. Stick around. It's a pretty amazing conversation. Ready or not, and I'm sure you're all more than ready, we're headed into the 2014 garden season. And I'm proud to have Christy Weber Landscapes and Christy Weber Farm and Garden back as a sponsor of the Mike Novak Show, and there are some changes. Christy Weber Farm and Garden has a new website. Just go to CWFNG.com or spell it out, Christy Weber Farm and Garden.com. Think of it as an urban oasis. Folks who stop by can't get over the vibe, and I'm really not surprised. It's a cool place right in the heart of the city. They have everything you need, from urban beekeeping, chicken keeping, to the extensive wild bird feed department, from trees and shrubs to the freshest perennials and annuals in season, seed starting to certified organic vegetable and herb starts. Check out their free classes as well. Composting with Anna Maria on Thursday, March 27th. That's this Thursday. And fairy gardening with Sophie on Thursday, April 3rd. Also, this is the time to get seeds started, as I mentioned, and CWFNG has a wonderful selection. Christy Weber Farm and Garden, 2200 West Grand Avenue in the Ukrainian Village. Find them on Facebook or go to CWFNG.com. Also, Christy Weber Farm and Garden.com. Let them inspire you to create your own oasis.
Hi, my name is Peggy, and I publish Chicago's only local magazine dedicated to healthy and sustainable living. Natural Awakenings is available monthly, and we provide the latest news and trends about healthful living, including alternative and complementary medicine, fitness, good food and drink, healthy kids and families, and even healthy pets. Natural Awakenings also talks about local sustainability, gardening and environment, energy conservation, and green living. We feature local news and a calendar to help you stay connected. I can guarantee that each month you'll discover a new health tip, a tasty recipe, a service in your neighborhood, something that makes your life better. Natural Awakenings is free and available throughout the city and suburbs or online at nachicagonorth.com. Call us today at 847-858-3697 to learn more. That's 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good, live simply, laugh more.
If you haven't gone to Facebook, go there now. Go to Mike Novak on Facebook. We have to also, hey, Lisa, we've got to get that light. Do a share on the Mike Novak Show.
For which?
For the cookies.
Of course.
Oh, you did. Great. You got to see this. It's just unbelievable. And it's sitting right next to me. And it's everything I can do not to just grab one and shove it in my mouth. But many more photos are going to be necessary before I do that. It's just amazing, Audrey. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
I have some advice for those of you preparing to for the growing season, which should arrive any month now. That advice is have a cocktail. I'm serious, and I'm talking about a genus of plants called Geum. You say you've never heard of them? Well, when you read the article in the March-April issue of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, you'll realize that you probably know one of them, Geum trifolium. Anybody in the room? Geum trifolium? No? No? Nobody? No? No?
No.
Okay.
No. Sorry.
Okay. What if I said prairie smoke?
Still no.
Oh, you're supposed to help me out.
Oh, sorry. You know what? You need Sarah for that.
That's true. And she's not here today. Prairie smoke. That's a Midwest native. But there are also cultivated versions, many produced by a buddy of mine, Brent Horvath, of Intrinsic Perennial Gardens in, now I never know, maybe somebody in the room knows this. Is it Hebron or Hebron? I know one of them in Indiana is Hebron and the other's Hebron, and I never know which is which. No, nobody knows.
I think Hebron, Illinois. That's how I've heard it pronounced.
I think it's Hebron here and Hebron in Indiana, but I could be wrong. Okay. Whatever. He has come up with the cocktail series that includes varieties called, you're going to love these, Alabama Slammer, Banana Daiquiri, Cosmopolitan, Gimlet, Limoncello, Mai Tai, Sangria, Sea Breeze, and Tequila Sunrise. Those are all plants, and they're all GMs, and they all have colors that represent.
See, now I have a whole new interest.
There you go. when you pick up the magazine, there's my column on the inside back page. You'll need a cocktail after reading it. Pick up a copy of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine at locations all over Chicago. Better yet, get a subscription. Go to ChicagolandGardening.com or call 888-265-3600. 888-265-3600. You know, this is the perfect song, actually, for our discussion. This is Elton John, Burn Down the Mission. And it seems to me that is almost where we are with the light problem. Maybe we have to burn down the mission just to keep us all from suffering the ill effects of light pollution. I have to ask you a question, Mark, at the Adler Planetarium, you're right on the edge of the city. How do you see anything from there?
Honestly, it's really tough. Chicago is sadly literally a poster child for light pollution. It was featured, the night sky lights of Chicago were featured on the cover of National Geographic magazine.
As a good thing or a bad thing?
As a bad thing. An article about light pollution a few years ago. Mm-hmm. So we have this terrible, nasty distinction as being one of the worst places for light pollution. And we are hampered by that at the Adler. We have an observatory out back that the Doane Observatory, 20-inch professional-grade telescope that is capable of cutting-edge research. But we can't do effective research on that because of the lights in Chicago. I've tried. I was scooped by another team using a small amateur telescope in some city's suburbs.
Because of the
lights. Because
spill.
Of the because lights in Chicago, yeah.
Yeah. So, Audrey, you want to address this. You are crafting a letter to go to the Emanuel administration to say, we got to fix this problem. How do we fix it?
You know, we've got such a special opportunity. We can turn down the light pollution by turning up activism and people just getting involved. You know, it's just like the climate reality group. It's just individuals really can make a difference. We can basically on an individual level, we can look at what we do in our own yards. Mm-hmm. You know, we can take a look at our lighting. Any of the yard lighting that we use, does it happen to shine into our neighbors, you know, windows? Do we think
Well, of course it does. All right, let me stop you right there. Okay, we're all so darn scared of our neighbors and of everybody, every other human being on the planet, that we deliberately shine those lights because we're scared of gangs, we're scared of burglars, we're scared of everything. We're a frightened species, and that's one of the reasons we have lit up this planet, is because we don't trust our fellow human beings, and we want to monitor them every second of the day. I don't see how we reverse that.
Well, we have a lot of choices. For example, we can use lights that have that are motion activated. They have timers or they have dimmers. We want to make sure that if we do use light in our property, which we have every right to do, that it stays within our property lines, that it doesn't cross into our neighbor's property, just like we wouldn't turn up the stereo just because there's a certain tune on that we absolutely love and we think our neighbors should hear it too at the same time.
Well, if you do that in a van, you might end up being shot, okay? So, and that's, again, it just proves what I'm talking about. But you pointed out something to me that I put up on my website, MikeNovak.net. If you go to this week's show, there's an Illinois Coalition for Responsible Outdoor Lighting. I had no idea. Okay, I had no idea that anything like this existed. And they show the difference between what they call good and bad light fixtures, and it's stunning. It's absolutely stunning.
Absolutely.
The photos are there. You can go click on them and just see the difference.
Right. It's just educating yourself a little bit about the decision making. You know, it's when you buy a light, it's not like buying a light for your Barbie house. You know, there really is technical designs that basically the bottom line is all the light should point downward, nothing sideways, nothing up into the sky. People that love their trees so much, it's so much that they want to shine a light upward into to the tree.
That's just not a good idea. But
not a good idea for the birds or
that's,
the tree.
Okay, got to stop you right there again. Mm-hmm. That's the industry that I represent to some degree on this radio show, which is the horticultural industry. And their idea is shine the stuff up into the trees so we get a dramatic effect. And you would say, put the light at the top of the tree and shine it down, maybe, or something else.
How about no
well,
light?
For a flagpole, I would say put the light at the top of the flagpole and shine down. But as far as a tree, you know, Dr. David Blask will tell you that every single living creature has a circadian, and they also need this melatonin. And even a single-celled organism has retained the necessity to reset its biological clock. That is how intrinsically important it is. So for the tree itself, it's much happier if it has a night in a day. And same thing with the birds that are nesting in it.
The biodiversity in the tree, the insect. In fact, let's bring in again Dr. Blask. Is Audrey making sense here?
Yes, she's making a lot of sense. Yeah, the all species have a biological timing system that's been conserved throughout evolution. And Audrey's right. You can go back 3.8 billion years in the evolution of the Earth, and you see single-celled organisms such as cyanobacteria that have circadian rhythms. In fact, they have a nighttime melatonin rhythm. And the molecule melatonin, I didn't really clarify this earlier, but melatonin is one of the signals from the brain that tells all the cells, tissues, and organs of the body what time of the day or night it is. That's how the master brain clock communicates this information about light dark cycles and timing to the cells in the body. And all organisms from single-celled organisms to complex organisms such as ourselves have this timing mechanism and have melatonin. Even plants have their own intrinsic timing system, and we're finding that at least the plants that have been studied, especially edible plants, make their own melatonin. They have melatonin.
Wow.
So the photosynthetic capabilities of plants are obviously linked to daytime sunshine, but there are intrinsic mechanisms that partially involve melatonin, and we're just learning about this now, that are important for the survival and thriving of plant species.
Does it mean, Doctor, that we're messing with the plant melatonin when we shine lights on them at night?
I don't know that for sure. There's no evidence for that yet, But I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if light pollution is not only detrimental to other animal species, as Audrey mentioned, in terms of their migratory patterns and reproductive patterns, but also to plant species as well. So we just take it for granted that, well, you know, you're going to shine some light up in the air or on plants, it'll look nice, and not really understanding the biology of these organisms, and not realizing that we could be doing something quite detrimental.
You know, it's interesting. I didn't know how I was going to weave this into the conversation today. Sometimes I pick up stuff and I bring it to the station, and now I've just found the perfect place, because geneticists have assembled the genome of a living creature with more than 23 billion base pairs, seven times the size of a human's, the largest one ever sequenced. Anybody want to guess what the plant is? It is a plant. It's a loblolly pine. Okay. Yeah. And you kind of go, huh?
Yeah.
But it just tells you that there are things that we don't know yet. We're still figuring these kinds of things out. We just have a few more minutes here. How do we get the ball rolling, Audrey?
Well, for the one thing, we're at a super special crossroads right now, and we're about ready to relight the city of Chicago, which, by the way, is scientifically measured the most light-polluted city in the world.
Woohoo! We're number one! Wait. There we go.
Oh, gosh.
Yet another victory.
So what we really...
Go, Team Chicago!
What we really need is to insist that the lights that we use are all shine downward. Mm-hmm. We can ask for lights that are timed with dimmers, so we don't need them as bright at 3 o'clock in the morning as we do at 11 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
They also have, keep them out of the blue spectrum. There are...
And you say we're going to make a trip. And by the way, Dave and Bob, I'm going to get to you in just a second here. I almost forgot about our phone calls, but I do want to bring them in. We're going to make that transition to LEDs, and the idea is we need to lobby. We need to go to the city and say, you got to do this smart. You can't just do it the way we've done it in the past, right?
And we can't just preach to the choir about this kind of stuff. It's easy to get fixed on the aesthetics of it, but there are incredible practical reasons for reducing light pollution, as we heard from Dr. Blask. The light pollution is unnecessary. It's unhealthy. It's actually unsafe for us, and it's wasteful. There is no reason.
Yeah,
for
the energy waste is staggering. Let's go to the phones very quick. Dave in Piatone, you're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Good. I'm glad you called in. What do you want to contribute?
Well, I'd like to share a success story, which I posted on your Facebook page, where I actually got some streetlights changed by my house. Because I have an upstairs to my house where both my kids sleep on the second floor, and the streetlights were literally shining into their bedrooms on the second floor. And these aren't lights that are like right next to the house; they're about 150 feet away, and they would cast shadows into their rooms. That's how bright they were. And so, through trying to get a hold of ComEd through the their online stuff, I kept running into roadblocks. They'd come out at the wrong time. I'd ask them to come out at specific times. They wouldn't. What I eventually did was I went to my village and said, hey, what can we do about this? They got me in touch with their liaison at ComEd, who contacted me within a couple days. He came out, took a look at the lights. He left a hanger on my door telling me what he had done. And within 3 days, I had two new street lights that light up the intersections near my house, and you can see on the picture the dramatic difference where the old one literally was shining all over the place, and the new one just shines down at the intersection, lights up what it needs to down below it, but it doesn't light up my daughter's bedrooms.
I'm looking at it right now. By the way, this is David Fuller. He's with eyesonthesky.com, and obviously this is a battle you've been fighting for a while.
Yes, it is. I make short YouTube videos that help people to find things in the night sky, even from places as light polluted as the Adler Planetarium. I do sometimes go up there and help people find things in the sky. But so at most anywhere that they can, you know, that you can see even just a few stars or even the brighter planets, I try and show them that and also talk a little bit about how to help reduce light pollution.
Hey, Lisa, let's see if we can share David's post. He on the main page of did you already do that? Oh, she's way ahead of me. She's always got this going. David, thank you so much for contributing. Again, his website is www.eyesonthesky.com. And what would your advice be to approaching the city about this?
I would say that what they need to do is just remember that, particularly if we're going to LED lights, LEDs are directional. They've got a little lens in them that points the light in a specific direction. So you have to design a light badly to make the light go sideways and up. So if we just keep the lights directed in where the direction they need to go, which is down, then we can help reduce the problem pretty substantially and without a lot of effort.
All right, David, thank you so much for calling, and good luck on your efforts, and thanks for your contribution. Have a great Sunday.
Thanks, Mike. You too.
Let's go to Bob, who's, I understand, Bob, you're in Arizona?
Yes, I'm calling from Sierra Vista, Arizona.
And I see here you're the past president of the Astronomical League.
The Astronomical League, and also past president of the International Dark Sky Association.
Aha.
If I could, I'd like to just address one of your concerns, which was the crime and security issue.
Yes.
That is one of the most difficult issues in this to address.
Of course.
And, you know, I can relate to this because I was afraid of the dark when I was a boy, and my mother used to leave the bedroom light on for me, and then when I'd fall asleep, she'd turn it off. And lots of us are afraid of the dark. But I often ask the question, are criminals afraid of the dark? Do criminals need light to see to commit crime? And when you put a bright light around, say, an ATM machine at night, and you walk up to it and you're blinded by the glare, who benefits from that light, you or the criminal who's hiding in the bushes to the side? You know, there's a lot more to lighting than just turning on a light. We all feel safe, but are we really? So that's one of the most difficult challenges.
That's
the other thing I'd like to address is just the overall change to our environment. For millions and millions of years, all life on Earth evolved with a day and a night. Who are we to change the night into day without understanding exactly what we're doing to migrating birds, to sea turtles, to the plants, to the insects? Some species of insects vanish because of all the bright lights. So what are we doing? Do we understand that? And then, of course, there's the human health impacts and so many other things. And the bottom line is, this isn't like nuclear waste. This isn't like all the other really serious environmental challenges we face. This one has an easy solution. It's shine lights down, keep them dim, turn them off when you don't need them, use the right amount of light in the right spectrum, and we'll all live safer, healthier, protecting wildlife, and preserving the magnificent beauty of the night sky that we're all losing touch with.
Bob, that's eloquently put, and I appreciate your contribution. We're flat out of time, but thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate that. You have a good...
Pleased to be able to participate, and I wish you all luck in having good lighting codes like we have in Cochise County, Arizona, that protect the night.
Well, we're going to work on it here, but, you know, we're a little backwards in Chicago. We're trying to work on it. All right, have a great one. Take care.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You very much.
And I would guess this is a big educational hurdle with aldermen.
Oh,
it is.
Everything's a big educational hurdle with aldermen, okay?
I mean, I've had a few who don't
Everything.
Speak.
And one thing that Chicagoans may not realize, but there's a mandate on the books that demands that streetlights shine to the keyhole of the front door, the typical residential Chicago street. And that same light that shines to the keyhole of the front door also shines into people's bedroom windows.
Of course it does.
Which is, we have to get our people to call our aldermen and demand that to stop.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that next Saturday at 8:30 p.m. is Earth Hour, where people turn off their lights for an hour and this is the perfect timing for this. For those people who are concerned with this issue, this would be a great way to get on board. And I've got the link to Earth Hour on my website and the link to the various groups here that, Chicago Astronomical Society and the Illinois Coalition for Responsible Outdoor Lighting. So go to my website and read about it. And Audrey, thank you for being here. And Mark, I appreciate Dr. Blask. Thank you so much for being on the phone. I appreciate that, too.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it.
Have a great Sunday.
You too.
You too. Yes, Audrey?
People are welcome to come down to the Adler for two things. The second Friday of April, we're going to have a talk at 7 p.m. about light pollution issues. It's free. It's no charge. Just come on down and have some fun. Go to the south entrance. And also, we've got the total lunar eclipse on April 15th at midnight
cool.
to 4 a.m. on the 15th.
You won't see it in
free.
Chicago, but
you'll see the lunar eclipse.
I know. I'm kidding. I was making a bad joke. All right. Well, I hope people take advantage of it. We'll be right back.
If you've ever filed a lawsuit, you know that it can be stressful, even traumatic. And if you've been exposed to asbestos, silica dust, or other lung toxins, you're going to need a law firm that can guide you through the legal maze efficiently and effectively. The attorneys of Penn Rakowski are exactly who you're looking for. They view each client and their needs as unique. They're focused on one thing and one thing only, lung disease. And they're based right here in Illinois and Wisconsin. The lawyers at Penn Rakowski have been representing individuals suffering from lung disease and their families for a combined 35 years. And because they're local, they can come to you. They've successfully represented asbestos workers, electricians, carpenters, machinists, and others throughout both states. Contact Penn Rakowski at dustlaw.com or call them toll-free at 888-LUNG-LAW. That's 888-LUNG-LAW. Penn Rakowski, local, committed, caring.
Looking for a housing investment that can pay big dividends? Remodel your kitchen or bathroom. You'll freshen up your home and add value to it, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for all your remodeling needs. Kitchens, bathrooms, master suites, and more. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Allergies acting up, trouble breathing, headaches, sinus pressure, you're tired, congested. Isn't it time to feel better? Breathe deeply and easily. Get rid of the symptoms that complicate your life. Dr. Bonnie Flaster is an acupuncturist and chiropractor who helps people get rid of allergies without using drugs, shots, or needles. Call Dr. Flaster at River North Wellness Center, 312-642-7545, or go to rivernorthwellness.com to find out how to get your body feeling better so you can enjoy life again.
I'm sure you've heard of the term called greenwashing. That's when companies try to cash in on the green movement, but in reality, they're just trying to sell their products. First, about that, do your homework. Don't get taken in by marketing claims. Second, if you want to know a company that is really green, check out Recycled Granite. In 5 years, owner Julie Rizzo has kept 30 million pounds of granite from ending up in landfills by creating methods, machinery, and markets to recycle scrap granite. They resize the material into user-friendly dimensions that are more efficient and economical to transport and install. Their recycled split stone tiles are split thin, allowing twice the coverage of traditional tiles, greatly reducing environmental impact. Their recycled granite pavers are 3 times stronger than concrete pavers and will never fade or wear. And even better, Recycled Granite established something called the Green Abilities Program. Individuals with disabilities go through a Recycled Granite Artisan Apprentice certification. The program teaches them how to specifically work with recycled granite waste. Now, that's what I call green and responsible. Go to recycledgranite.com, find them on Facebook, or call 800-692-4642. 800-692-4642. We got about 2 minutes left here. Lisa, what's going on?
Well, I have been speaking a bit in public on climate these days, and I have a workshop. I shouldn't say I. Dan Hunshaw and the great folks over at oh my gosh, I'm blanking on the name of the church. Countryside Church Universal Unitarian Universalist will be hosting a seminar on April 5th. And they have put together an incredible group of people. Jerome McDonald from BEZ is going to be the moderator. And they've got folks from 350.org, Citizens Climate Lobby, and a big focus for this. And I'm seeing this trend happening all over. And that is that religious organizations realizing the responsibility of stewardship towards solutions when it comes to climate change. So I think on one level, there's a big hurdle to be overcome in terms of education. But I think, too, what we need to be in dialogue on how we're going to solve these problems and how we can unite. And I think that there's yesterday I was at an event that was also church based. And I think there's an interesting combination. You know, we've had the folks from Israel.
K-A-M Isaiah,
you know, talking about gardening and what we can all do. And this is yet another one of those events. So it'll be on April 5th, and it's ccuu.org, and you can find some information about that.
And post it on Facebook.